logical ethics, unknown misery.
Your business, man, you a genius.
Loud,
man.
Mathematic, production by Soul for Hire. Tragic days.
I don't wanna die by the hands of my brother like Cain. In the eyes of my mother, seen her drowning with pain. It's the cries of my people disregarded in vain. Single mothers left to struggle, no one guarded the brain. Welfare, healthcare, whoever started the game. From cradle to the grave, they wanna treat us like slaves. Don't need a quarter, need a change, they can't amount to bills. To put the borders on my land, we got some mouths to fill. Without a chance, choking with bail, they choke with ropes. Turn the hope into dope, cause they hope will be choked. But I'm defiant, stand firm with my lines. Burn the Bible on the collar. Colonize upon the tyrant, remain a rebel to the devil's systematic ways. Remain strong for the cause through these tragic days.
The banging guns won't stop gun violence, changing mindsets will.
Now let's go.
Mixtape.
I'm trapped in a whirlwind. Wrote tons of rhymes for songs you never heard spin. A burden I'm born to bear in my own version. If you listen, you hear the hunger and the passion my emotion prepare. Together with the ganja sparked up in the flare. Yeah, my stomach touching my ribs, my food fed to my kids. But I gotta hold on cause it's feeling like a long bed. The young black and gifted up on the rise. White collar stepping and industrialized. We must realize civilized a barbarian is dwelling inside. It was a state of emergency.
I'm tired of my people walking like sheep for the slaughter. To my brothers blasting guns with your African tongue. Still we dance to the rhythm of the African drum. Yo, this land was built on bloodshed, enough dead. So what's next? I'm sick of these histories missing me. Enough said, genocidal wars on the black and the poor. Families torn, got me knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. But all I hear is whispers followed by a slither. Souls quiver in the winter, will the father deliver? Blood in my eyes, lost the love of my life. And there is nothing I can do but bring my life to a new. A phoenix spawned from these ashes while you're lost in the traffic. The cost could be tragic, have you barked in the casket. It's one thing we know how to survive. Change with the times, I'm taking back what was rightfully mine.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the basement of Carruthers Hall, Queen's University Campus, Kingston, Ontario, Turtle Island. And you're listening to The Massive. I'm DJ Fras, and I'm here with a very special guest in studio today. Do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Rosa Gutierrez. I'm a first-year student here at Queen's. I helped Anna Thomas working on the Black experience of blackness in Kingston.
Yay. Really excited to have you on the show today.
Oh, thank you.
Because today we are airing the second part two of Anna's three-part radio documentary series, which we're very excited about. But first, we're going to start off today's show with a few community announcements. So the first one is today is the 14th of February, as I'm sure you're probably aware. But today is also the 20th anniversary of the annual Women's Memorial March for Missing and Murdered Native Women, which has happened every year for the past 20 years in Vancouver's downtown Eastside neighborhood. If you're not familiar with the Memorial March, it was begun by a group of mostly Native women in the downtown Eastside who were friends or sisters or mothers or daughters of Native women who had gone missing or who had been murdered in recent years. And the march was held to draw attention to the fact that These women had experienced violence, had gone missing, or had been murdered, and nothing was being done about it, and their concerns were not being heard by any kind of authorities or anyone with the power to, like, investigate or do anything about these crimes that were happening. So it began as a really small march of sort of just a few women, and I believe the first couple of years that they did it, things were, like, thrown at them out of windows, and it was not well received. But since then, the march has grown in strength, and last year there were 5,000 people marched to draw attention to not only the missing and murdered women from the downtown east side, but also the more than 3,000 missing, some say estimates of up to 3,000 missing and murdered Native women across Canada. So this year, there's been, for the past couple of weeks, there have been a number of events around Vancouver to draw attention to this epidemic of violence against Native women, and to draw attention to also, like, where that violence comes from, which is rooted in a long history of colonialism in Canada. And so today, that march is happening today, and also there are going to be solidarity marches in cities across Canada.
So for our next event, upcoming event, a presentation by Daniel Heath Justice, analyzing critical kinship in theory and practice. It'll be taking place in Chernoff Hall, 117, tomorrow, so the 15th at 6 p.m., with a reception to follow at the University Club Fireside Lounge. Daniel Heath Justice is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation and holds the position of Associate Professor of Aboriginal Literature in the Department of English and Affiliated Faculty in the Aboriginal Studies at the University of Toronto. He has written Our Fire Survives the Storm, a Cherokee literary history and of the Indigenous Fantasy Trilogy, The Way of Thorn and Thunder, as well as a numerous amount of essays on literary criticism and critical theory in Indigenous studies. So I think that's something you all should go to. Promises to be a very eye-opening experience.
Yeah, very exciting. To have Daniel Heath Justice here in Kingston, and immediately following that amazing event is another great event, Dr. Norman Finkelstein. Finkelstein is giving a talk put on by SPHR, Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, called Israel and Palestine, Past, Present, and Future. And this is happening in Ethering Auditorium tomorrow evening at 7:30. So it's again right following Daniel Heath Justice. So there should be time to run from one to the other, yeah. Which is what I will be doing. So Dr. Finkelstein received his doctorate in 1988 from the Department of Politics at Princeton University, and for many years he's taught political theory on the Israel-Palestine conflict, and he's currently an independent scholar. Tickets are $10 and can be purchased online for students, $10 for students.
With your ID.
Yes, and $15 for non-students. And yeah, so you can also email sphr@gmail.com to get tickets.
So our next event would be taking place on Wednesday, February 16th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. It's a film screening called Stolen from Africville and Remembering Africville. It's an amazing movie. It's about, amazing documentary actually. It's about the upheaval and of blacks in Africville, small community in Nova Scotia, about the relocation, like the forced relocation of these people into areas that were less than sufficient in terms of sanitation, in terms of living communities and economic opportunities. It is an amazing movie. It's very thought-provoking, and it makes you think about stuff that we as Canadians often ignore. So I think it's a really good movie to see, and I encourage you to go out and see it. It's again at Wednesdays, on Wednesday 16th, 7 to 10, in John Orr Room in the JDUC on the third floor, excuse me.
Yeah, the third floor. floor. It's confusing. John, our room has been mysteriously relocated from the second floor to the third floor, so be sure to go to the third floor.
Third floor. Okay.
And also, along with this film screening is some members from the group Stolen from Africa, which is a collective in Toronto, are going to be coming out also to sort of facilitate a bit of a discussion and to answer some questions also about their documentary Stolen from Africville, which is going to be screened with Remember Africville. So yeah, you definitely want to check out this event. It's being put on by QCRED, Queen's Coalition Against Racial and Ethnic Discrimination, and it is a Black History Month event, so be sure to come check this out. And then on Thursday, this is a very busy week, lots of exciting things happening. 7 p.m. on Thursday in Turnoff Hall, room 117, is a teach-in on the Egyptian Revolution. So if you're curious about learning more about what's been going on in Egypt for the past couple of weeks, if you've been glued to Al Jazeera, like a lot of us here at The Massive have been, and you want a bit more context to what's been happening, then you should definitely come check this out. The list of speakers includes Mohamed Abdou, Dr. Mohamed Bayoumi, Dr. Adnan Hussein, Dr. Dana Olwan, Nasser Saleh, Dr. Ariel Salzman, Khaled Shaheen, and Dr. Aliyah Zurich. And this is a free event. And I think it's also going to be recorded and broadcast on CFRC sometime after it happens. So if you can't make it out on Thursday, tune in to CFRC for the details on when it's going to be rebroadcast.
And it's also taking place at Chernoff Hall in room 117. So, Culture Shock is currently looking for submissions regarding an anti-racist reviews. Culture Shock is an anti-racist publication that strives to provide a form of artistic expression for those who have been historically and are currently marginalized in today's society. So, it's a space that is created for voices that are systematically excluded. Culture Shock seeks to give a space to people who have been rendered voiceless and feel invisible, allowing them to express their voices in whichever style and medium they choose. So if you are interested in writing a poem or writing an essay or a prose or taking pictures or whatever you feel is best to express yourself, they're definitely interested, and you can contact them with your info or anonymously as well at cultureshock@ams.queensu.ca. For larger files, so ones that include like audio or high resolution photos, whatever, you can send those to faith.16@gmail.com. Okay?
And they're due February 18th at 11 a.m., so you can submit anytime until then. So if you don't have anything to submit yet, you still have
lots of time to think about it, yeah.
And I think that's it for our community announcements.
Busy week, guys.
Lots of exciting things happening in Kingston that you should all check out. So now I think we're just going to talk a little bit here with Rosa about sort of her experiences working to create this documentary with Anna over the summer. Yeah, and I guess just a bit about what that experience was like. So can you tell us a bit more about sort of what the project is and how you became involved?
So the project basically started out as a way to uncover the experience of blackness in Kingston. It's exactly what the title is, just to really understand how, in my opinion, such a small population, such a small part of the community in Kingston has interpreted being part of a marginalized race in a city that's definitely predominated by white culture and white society. I got involved in the project with Keys. Like, Keys was doing like a summer employment, and they hooked me up with this job, and so that's the bare bottom way I got involved. It was a great experience. It was a really It's a really good experience. I enjoyed Anna a lot. I enjoyed meeting the people I met. Everyone was really nice. Everyone was really, really sweet here. And definitely raised my expectations for entering Queens for the first time.
So what has it been like since you're a first year student? So when you were here in the summer, it was like there weren't that many students around.
Yeah. And I was here in the summer, and it was pretty much dead. I think basically it was just like grad students and people who didn't make it home for the summer vacation. So it was very limited, and I thought that everyone I had met was so nice that I thought that as soon as school started it was all gonna be like that, except just so much more. It was gonna be, I don't know how many students we have here, like 13 or is it 20?
Like
24, like 1,000 kids. Like, I mean, I thought it was just gonna be, everyone was gonna be nice, everyone was gonna be sweet, it was gonna be just a blast, right? So I definitely wasn't prepared for, you know, the first day was fine because everyone's in class, everyone's new, everyone's like first year, oh my goodness, nice to meet you, shaking hands, whatever, right? And then as the days progressed, it started becoming less of that and more, you know, colder, more absorbed, more hostile, in my opinion. And it took me a while to actually get used to the school. Like, I didn't feel comfortable here, and I wouldn't necessarily say I do now. When you're growing up and you're like, you're told, like, I was told constantly after asking my mother, like, you know, Mom, I want to meet friends. I want to meet people who are like me. I want to meet, you know, a boyfriend. I want to meet this. I want all these things. Like, I want all that selection in front of me. And my mom always said, wait till you get to university. Wait till you get to university. Wait till you get to university. And now that I'm here, I still find it limited. Granted, the friends that I do have are amazing, and like, I wouldn't ask for anyone different because they're perfect. But it was a while, and it took me a long time to get used to that idea that I'm not gonna be among people who look like me. I'm not gonna be among people who act like me or think like me. They're all gonna be different. It's really bad to say this, but a lot of them are the stereotypical Torontonian, white, blonde, you know, not much going on beneath the makeup, type of personality, and it's very frustrating. It was very frustrating because you come to university thinking you're gonna be challenged, you think you're gonna be inspired by people, you're gonna meet people who are academically inclined just as much as you are, like in terms of holding and discussing like real debates and real issues and bringing things that have been swept under the rug for so long, like really lifting up that rug and trying to uncover all the dirt that's underneath it. And it's not like that, in my opinion. It's not. And it could just be my year. It could just be first year. And maybe as I get older, as I get into more classes that specify to what I like, it'll change. But for now, it's not what I expected. I think of Queens as a university. I don't think of it as much else. It's a place to learn. It's a place to stay at home, which is nice. That's why I didn't go or leave the city, because I get to stay home. But other than that, I don't think I don't understand the community that they keep on bragging about. I'll just say and leave it at that. I don't feel there's a community here, and I feel like people just say that there is to win elections. They say what it is because they want something out of it. It makes them sound better. It makes them feel included. I don't feel like anyone feels like it's a community because it's so expanded, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's like a theme that comes up a lot, and like, the documentary last week, like the idea of a community, and of specifically like a Black community in Kingston. And yeah, Anna was talking to like a lot of people who are like Kingston residents, and then also like a few people who are Queens students, and there was like some like differences mm-hmm. in like those experiences.
But I think if you boil down, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but I think if you boil down to what everyone was saying is that no, there is no community. Mm-hmm. There is no feel or no sense of that, you know, bond or that one thing that you kind of unites everybody. There is none of that, and that's kind of unfortunate. It's definitely unfortunate. It's not kind of, it's unfortunate, because then you think to yourself, there's no one like me, right? And it's not like a good way, like, oh, I'm special, I'm unique. It's, I'm different. There is a circle and I'm not in it, you know? That was definitely my feelings for the first few weeks when I got here. Like, I've grown into it now, and I like school, but I like school because I like the school. I don't like Queens. I don't like the university, but as an institution to learn. I think it's great. I have a privilege that unfortunately many people don't have, and I have to recognize that too. That like I'm in a position right now where I have a voice that where there are so many people right now who don't, and like that needs to be called out too. Like I can't just go on this you know rant about how like you know how marginalized my identity is when, in my opinion, I don't feel it. I personally am not affected by that marginalized. I can't think of the word, but like.
To like broader systemic.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'm not subjected to, I mean, I could be subjected to that, like in very minute, very acute ways that I barely even notice. There was one incident where I was in like, just happened like a few weeks ago, where I was in a store. And as soon as I walked in, like there was this woman there and she was eyeing my family. There was a whole bunch of other family, like there's a whole bunch of other white people in the store, but it was my family, and my mom and my grandma like are darker toned. Like they're not black. They're Spanish. They're from Chile. But it was so uncomfortable with how she was staring at my family. It was so uncomfortable. That was the first time I ever actually got publicly angry at someone, and I yelled at someone in the store. It was the first time, and every single time I see that happen, I'll call it out. And unfortunately, I'm in a place where I feel safe enough to do that. When there are so many people right now who don't have that power and who don't have that voice. So I have to call that out and say that for as much as I'm talking, I do need to recognize that I do have a privilege in the situation.
So what is it like to hear the documentary last week now?
Oh, yeah,
after
yeah.
Like so many months of...
It's so weird because like you I remembered it. It was a great experience. But you have your essays and you have your work and you kind of forget about it. Like you don't like completely forget about it, but it's in the back of your mind. And some of the things I was hearing myself say, I'm like, do I really feel about that way like now? Do I really feel the same way? I can't cite a specific example. All I remember is thinking, I don't really remember feeling this way. Like I remember how I felt when I was doing it, but now I don't feel like I feel that way. And I think that's because I have such amazing friends. I have two, and they are what I wanted when I went to university. Like they are the people that I dreamed of having in terms of friendships. People who are there for you, people who go out of their way to make sure that, you know, your mind is in a healthy place and supporting you constantly. And that's what I wanted. So I feel like when I was doing like this work, I didn't have that. I didn't have that support, and I didn't have those friendships, and I didn't have those relationships that I really, really craved. But now that I have them, I do feel definitely different than what I did. Not to say that I was wrong. I don't think by any means I was wrong. But I do feel that it's different for everyone. And as they progress, your experiences shape you differently, for sure.
I think that's a great segue into part two of Anna's radio documentary.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear too what's gonna be on this one. Like I haven't listened to it yet, so I'm sure it's gonna be amazing.
All right, so in just a few seconds, you'll hear part two of Anna Thomas's radio documentary Experiences of Blackness in Kingston, and been here chatting with Rosa Gutierrez, who helped Anna, helped produce the documentaries this summer. All right, so thank you for talking to us today, Rosa, and enjoy part two, everyone.
Black in Kingston. How do I feel about being black in Kingston? At times, being black in Kingston, at times I feel lost, but I've gotten used so much to my lostness that it looks normal or feels normal.
This is part two of Experiences of Blackness in Kingston. The following interviews were conducted over the months of July and August 2010 by Anna Thomas and Rosa Gutierrez. For more information on this and the other documentaries in the Kingston Black History Project, please visit oprahkingston.org.
savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, keep points, and all of a sudden you are saying Indiana Jones. And I take all the gold and take all the scrolls and even the bird bones.
My name is Jamila Abdullah, and I work here at Queen's University, and I've been involved with Black History Month for the last 8 years in Kingston, and I'm glad to be interviewed today.
My name is Jerry Lutaya, and I just graduated from Queen's in June, and I like riding my bike.
My name is Cartwright Livingston Hyphen Deuteronomy Christian. I was born in Antigua in 1942. I lost my mom at the age of 9. I am still wondering whether I'm still trying to find out whether she drowned or she was murdered. As a young boy, I was very active. I was pretty good in school. My schoolwork was good, in sports, etc. And I decided to cut that short because I wanted to be a man doing things for myself. So at 17, I went out to work.
Do you have a sense of a Black community in Kingston?
Do I have a sense of it?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's very small at this point. And we sort of pass each other on the street and smile, but in some cases avoid contact. And I think the Black community is not really established, but it's getting there. It is getting there,
mm-hmm.
and which is a nice thing to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
So would you say like you ever experienced, or there was one moment where you experienced a culture shock?
I can't think of a particular moment, but I think in my first year, there was an article in the journal. They were doing like a 3-part series about like issues of diversity on campus or something, and one of the like the front page of the journal that week had like a pie chart of all the different like demographics of Queens, like the demographic makeup of people at Queens, and it was like African American. There was like a little sliver, and then it was just like the way it was broken down, it was like, oh wow, yeah, that's right, and that's kind of weird. So maybe that was my moment of culture shock, just like kind of realizing that different to my high school, which I guess I didn't really make the connection between the two because that's all I had known. But yeah, I guess that moment.
Do you have a sense of a Black community in Kingston?
No. Really, that's a truth, because when I came to Kingston, that's what I was looking for. I'm talking 18 years ago, and I can barely see a Black person. And after I came to Kingston a year, after I arrived, I started coming to school, and I thought that's where I'm gonna see more Black people, or more. I'm not even sure at that time if I am Black or not. That's another story. But I just couldn't see any. I can rarely see Black people. The few people I were identifying as Black, I knew were international students, and they are few, and they go back, right? So you lose them in a few years, but it just felt, because I lived in Toronto right after I came back from Africa, and I felt like, oh, there is people who looks like me and talk like me, and it felt safer, I would say. It felt, because I'm coming to Canada, I'm expecting all white, right, people, and I thought probably I will be the only Black person around, but that wasn't the case. In Kingston, it's just, yeah, and it seems like probably we were the first Black people coming here. I realized later there's people, Black people who lived here for hundreds of years, but they were not visible enough for us to see. So it felt different, it felt strange, almost.
Do you have a sense of a Black community in this area?
In Kingston?
Yeah.
Lacking. I when I came to Ajax in 1984, one of the things that that used to happen there is that every year, because I started the Pickering Carib Canadian Cultural Association when I lived in the Ajax Pickering area, I'm the founder, and when I moved here and took the job here, we had the friendship and the community we had up there wanted to follow me if they could, but they couldn't. But one of the things that Kingston had was folklore. And this folklore was vibrant. They had the Afro-Carib Association here that were doing very good. It didn't take long because, as usual, just like the Caribbean islands, they started splitting, and they had the Jamaica that went by themselves, and then the Carib Club continued for a while, but then after that, they all faltered. But, however, I used to have the whole group come down, stay at my place in Ajax. In Ajax, I keep remembering Ajax, but I mean in Napanee. Come to my place in Napanee, and then we all come to Kingston and enjoy folklore. At that time, you went to the Caribbean Pavilion, which was the most vibrant then, and you met the people who were here. And over the years, it just faltered. So my connection then with the Caribbean Pavilion community down here happened in 96, because in 96, I came and leased a hall on Brock Street. No, it's not Brock Street. It's on Bath Road, sorry. Mm-hmm. It was the Zaubers. Mm-hmm. The owner had just died, and the daughters were renting the place out, and I seemed to have come at the right time. So I rented the property, and I changed it. It was called Amaretta Banquet Hall, and upstairs I had a place called the Reggae Zone, which means that I had the dances at night, but we had the big banquet facilities going downstairs. Very successful, started very well. During that period of time, I got to know a man named Kochochi. The family is still here, they still have a grocery store, but that old man, he loved culture, and it was a place that Caribbean people could go. In those days, he brought everything in, the yams, the dashin, the pumpkin, anything that's Caribbean, he would have. The son is trying to duplicate some of it now, but he doesn't have the market. At that time, there were also a couple other stores that had West Indian food in town. The way I usually describe it is that they were still hungry, so they associated with each other. But they all got affluent, they became teachers, they come university, they became doctors and stuff. And so all of a sudden they have the three cars in the driveway, three TVs in the house, and they don't care about anybody outside. So the culture seemed to just disappear. However, after Kochochi came to me, he says, "Can you imagine we having folklore and there's no Caribbean? There's nothing from the Caribbean, there's no African, there's nothing." And to me that was a challenge because I had just finished leaving Ajax Pickering where I started the association there. And so I called a few people and got them together, Robert James and a few other people, and I said, "Listen, if I run a pavilion, will you come and participate?" And so I brought them together, and I, again, in Kingston, I started the Kingston Afro-Caribbean Latino Association and re-entered folklore. I became a part of the Folk Art Council, a couple of the associations in Kingston to make sure, to try and bring the culture back. While I had Amaretta and was a center where I kept drawing people in, it worked.
What would you look for in a Black community here in this setting?
I think mainly assistance and support.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times you do feel this isolation, the cultural and racial isolation. But I really must admit that here in Kingston, there isn't that kind of curiosity days that you would perhaps experience in some other communities when you move to that community, and there aren't many African Canadians and African Americans in that community. But get this gaze of like, what's happening? The neighborhood's changing, and so I have the feeling of a little bit more anonymity.
Would you say that you've experienced racism in Kingston?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I experienced, I will say, probably all forms of racism, whether it's systemic or individual. It ranges from somebody just call you, you're just black, go back to your country, or we don't like you to be here, or just look at you and like, who are you and why are you here, to the extent that you will be discriminated against in school and if you apply for a job, and that polite racism where you won't be told that that's why we didn't hire you, that's why we don't like you, that's why we don't feel like you're part of this community, but it just came out and people just say it politely and saying that you're not qualified, or you are overqualified, or you are overeducated for this job, or you know, stuff like that. But you know, like, if you're somebody who experienced it, you know, no matter how other people try to minimize it and make you feel like you're just feeling it because you have problem, like you have issues, you just, but that's not the case. My family, my kids has experienced racism in school too, with their peers and their friends, and my husband has experienced racism at its ugliest funeral forms, and he won't be able to find work in Kingston, and he has to go find work in another city. And he went to school here, and he did tons of programs and did masters, and yeah, so Kingston is, and probably it's not, I don't know if it's about individuals' behaviors and there is people who are racist, or is it because just it's in the roots of how people think and do their things, and it's an institutional thing or individual thing, I'm not sure, but probably both. And Queens is a great example of where you can experience racism. It's just down there. We all know it, we all have seen it. So many incidents happened at Queens more than ever recently. I don't remember when I was students here, there were so many incidents like I've been recently, so I'm not sure what happened. Even though you see more people of color, you see more black people around in like staff, faculty and students, but you see more incidents of racism, and you wonder what the relationship, why are people upset, because there's more black people now, and they feel like, oh gosh, that's scary, we have more people now of color, or people who look different, or people who speak different, or whatever, and that's the reaction, or there is other reasons, I'm not sure.
Because of the circle of friends I kept, I was challenged into becoming a member of the Ontario Parole Board. I accepted the challenge and joined the Ontario Parole Board. I stayed there for 4.5 years, traveled the whole eastern region, and did parole board hearings in a lot of institutions, from Ottawa to Whitby. In Napanee, I happened to meet the superintendent, Gary Meyer, and they were having a lot of problems with their food, and there were a lot of misconducts happening there. So I, in the discussions back and forth, of course, he blamed the chefs, the cooks he had. Said, they're all army guys, they don't know how to cook, da, 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 da. And then there came another challenge. Why don't you come and do it? So I accepted the challenge, because by that time, my ex-wife and my two youngest children were living in Stirling. So he gave me an opportunity to come. I used to love being on the parole board, because I come out every month and I stop, and because my children, I used to say the government pays me for that. But moving to Napanee was a good chance, so I bought a property and moved into Napanee and run the kitchen at the jail, Quinte Detention Center, for 4.5 years.
How do you identify in terms of race, and what's the story behind you identifying as black?
Okay. I lived my first 27 years in Sudan, like my home country, and everybody is black, right? And I am just Jamila, the Sudanese person. So I came to Canada, and I was I came as a refugee, and I was asked at the border what my race is. And there is, I remember in the form you have to tick if you are black, original, I think, white, and I'm not sure what the other options are now. But I was not sure where to tick because of, I never thought of myself as a black person because it, no, I'm just, I saw the wonderful find as a thing that say African, right? Or like identify you by your nationality but not by your color, or, and I was like really confused what to tick, and then I ticked others because it wasn't any of these other categories. And I came in and my husband was in Canada, so I told him the story and he just laughed. I'm like, we're black. I'm like, really? So that was strange. So it took me a while, and then my identity has been challenged, I will say, in Canada. And I, for a while, for years, I wasn't sure what to say about myself. I am Sudanese, I'm African, that's I'm sure about. I could say that and I feel okay. But to identify as, and my reference would be race, was really strange. And then I was a refugee, but that would be temporary, so I wasn't sure what to say. And I'm like, so I'm like a woman slash African slash Sudanese. Well, I'm saying Sudanese because it's confusing too, because I thought I was Arab, because I speak Arabic and I'm Muslim. So I'm more identified with the Middle Eastern part of Africa more than the African part of Africa. And that's confusing too. So it was really a dilemma for me to decide who I am.
Experience.
Well, I'll tell you, the most interesting part of my life was the parole board. Getting on the Ontario Parole Board, I was the first black person on the Ontario Parole Board.
Okay.
And I can remember being, I was in the Eastern Region. Now, there's one time I was called and I was sent to the east, to the Western Region, because they had a case that they didn't know how to handle. It was a black person. And so I was sent up and I sat into the board meeting, and the gentleman walked out. I looked at him and I knew who he was. Because not only do I know a lot of the people in Ontario at that time, is that I was so associated with the Caribana Committee, because for 3 years I was the official caterer. And this Trinidadian was played a great part in making himself well seen and everything on the streets and in the parade. So when he walked out, he realized that he knew me too, and I said, "What the heck are you doing here?" And I think I broke him, because all of a sudden it wasn't a situation where he could come out and play his game. He's speaking to somebody like himself. And that was, I think, one of the best moves that parole board made at the time, because they start making you see people of your peer, and that helped. So we had a good chat. By the time it was finished, I had one more meeting up there with them, and he was sent out to a home, and I never heard anything negative. I didn't see a negative report, so I think that it was the right time, the right thing, and it worked.
Again, until today, like, and I tried to get in touch with the Arab community here in Kingston and Muslims, and it didn't feel right. I tried to get in touch with the African community, didn't feel right, perfectly right too, and I will always get the feeling like, you're not part of us, I go there, like, I'm not really part of that group too. So it was really, and I'm still struggling with that.
Do you like Kingston?
Yes, I do. And of course there were, when I first came here, this enthusiasm was dampened by a couple of experiences that I had. Mm-hmm. And when we had called, my husband and I, when we had called and I had inquired about a place for rent, and the gentleman told me that, of course, you would like this apartment. It's really nice. It's wonderful. And it's on the first floor, lots of sun. And so when I arrived there, he did this triple look, and he then said, "Oh, okay," and then he hesitated, then he said, "I don't think you're going to like this apartment that I have." And I said, "Oh?" And so he said, "Oh, yeah, well, come and see it." So we went down into this basement, and he knocked on this door, and this woman came to the door, and she had two smaller children in the back who were playing. And she looked at him, it was sort of a fright thing. She said, "Well, yes." And so he said, "Well, we're just going to look at the apartment." And she looked very frightened. And she was totally unaware that someone was looking at her apartment. And so he kept saying, "Well, you're not going to like this apartment and this, blah, blah, blah," and et cetera, et cetera. And so I received the message. I got the message very soon. And so as we were leaving, I turned to the woman and I said, "Don't worry." I said, "Your apartment isn't up for rent." I said, "You know, it's a matter of thinking here and backwards thinking." And I said, "And I wouldn't want to live here anyway." And so, you know, and this kind of thing has happened when I first came here. Mm-hmm. And, but unfortunately, when there's a bad experience, there are many other good experiences.
What's the story behind you living in Kingston? Why Kingston?
I think like most immigrants, Kingston is the university. Kingston is St. Lawrence College. Kingston is RMC. So most people who come to Kingston, especially immigrants or students at Queen's University, they come for because they have... They are going to school in one of these institutions, so that's why we came to Kingston. And then my husband went to school here, I went to school here, and then my sister went to school here. And then we are probably one of the few families who stayed after we finished school, because most people just go to other big cities because there is more job opportunities. I won't say there is less racism, but probably there is more opportunities for jobs and work and things like that. So, and that's why my husband now is in another town, another city, because of the same reason. But I finished school and I took my time going back to school, and then my kids start school here and they settled here, and we just then stayed. And
I learned also that we were able to cope in the islands with things that were that happened to us as youth that Canadians didn't. And how did I know that? Because when I read the files on the parole board, you see the same scenarios as you know happen in the islands, and those kids grow up and do a lot of good things, and up here you see them in the jail. They're in the jail because they can't mentally tell it to anybody. The shame and the problems they have drive them into the system. And that was a part of the program I dealt with when I made my program for the parole board. So it was the best part of my life.
So in your day-to-day life in Kingston, are you constantly aware of being in that minority?
Well, yes, you're always aware. And the only time I wasn't aware of being in a minority when I was living in Jamaica, when I was a majority, and it's an entirely different situation. It's a feeling of where you can breathe and not be seen. So you have you're constantly sort of put on up front, and your actions and everything really is put forward out into the public. And it's because, unfortunately, you represent everyone who looks like you.
Mm-hmm. So, and based on what I've been reading and hearing from other people, the 90s in Kingston seemed to be a really vibrant time for the Afro community.
Actually,
here.
I'd say the late 80s.
The late 80s.
The late 80s going into about the 1990 up to about 1997, because 1996 is when I left Amaretta, and it seems like nothing happened after that except I won a dance a year.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1996, I did my last, in 1997, I did my last folklore. And as a matter of fact, that year, all the cultures went under one roof at RMC. So it wasn't a selfish thing, I'm staying because I want to have my own little pavilion. We all, and I pushed for that because you could see it was dying. And it's not only the Caribbean culture, you could see a lessening of the different cultures, because now children come into Canada or were not listening to their parents the way children listened to their parents in my days. So they didn't want to go dance and do the bamboo dance, and they weren't going to go and spend hours after hours learning to do the Ukrainian dances, although the Ukrainian community as such is still very vibrant. What happened is that whether the parents got so greedy at chasing dollars that they didn't stay home long enough to continue to equate their children with their culture and where they came from and why it's important to be a part of it, that might have a lot to do with it. But the reality is that just about then, the last folklore was the one, and I was the chair, and we had the RMC, and we had conflicts because some people wanted to come, some people wanted to come. The Ukrainians say, oh no, we're going to keep our own pavilion. And little things like that kind of split the community as such. But the Carib Pavilion, as far as that goes, found very few people who really participated. And that's when it pretty well died.
Both Rose and I actually grew up being kind of the only black people in any of our classes. Rosa grew up in Kingston. I grew up in small towns in southwestern Ontario and up north. How do you think that the impact of not seeing people like you can affect the identity formation for children?
Oh, I think that's a wonderful question, because I dealt with a lot of children who were isolated racially and culturally. I think parents have to be aware that my child is the only one that's in this area. So what am I going to do? I had children who they were raised on a farm. You know, they were Quebec. The first thing I did, I started drawing pictures of black people doing marvelous things, painting them. And I had them above their beds. So the first thing, when they woke up in the morning, they saw this black doctor. And on the sides, they saw black scientists, peripheral learning. So I think being isolated is very difficult. That's why I mentioned that we do need support.
Mm-hmm.
We need that support. And you have to grow up feeling that there's nothing wrong with you, but there's a greatness within you. And great people and good people and ordinary good people should be associated with what you look like. And that should be a constant vision growing up when you're growing up isolated. You should see these visions of good, great people and ordinary people doing great things who look like you. I think that's very, very important. Because you see, we take a lot of our culture, who we are, from TV. We go around, and unfortunately, the people who do not have a lot of experience with black people take their image of us from the TV, too. So when we see these images, we think that's the way that we're supposed to act, and they think that's the way we're supposed to act. And we can't give TV that much power. We have to act the way we were meant to act. And so showing kids their greatness when they're isolated is so important. Otherwise, they grow up thinking that there may not be, there may be an inefficiency about the way they look. Because if they're in isolation and they only see their images on TV, unfortunately, those are not good images the vast majority of times.
Mm-hmm. If you had a microphone and could speak to all the Black people in Kingston and impart something, teach them something or say something to them, what would you want them to hear?
I want them to... My own observation is most Black people are bystander. Like, they just see things happen and they know these things happen to them, their children, and their community, but they are not doing anything about it. So I would like people to be involved and to work collectively in trying to change things, because we all work individually in our issues. And my son experienced racism in school. I will go and deal with it as a parent. But as Black parents in Kingston, for example, if I take Kingston as example, I don't remember we get together and talk about it and say, our kids is being discriminated against in school. And I know every single parent who has children in Kingston have experienced that. What can we do about it as community, as parents? I don't think we've done that. So I think we should get more organized and try to figure out how we can do more collective work to be able to help and change, to support ourselves first and foremost, and then to try to bring in change. So I think without doing that, and just to internalize the racism and not talk about it publicly, is going to be more harmful than useful to our Black communities, whether it goes somewhere elsewhere. So I think just getting together and do things collectively will be helpful. So.
Now, if you had a magic microphone.
Yes.
And could address something to all the, you know, Black people in this area and extending that to Canada, what would you want to teach them or say to them?
I would like to tell them that all of we, and we sustain, I think I can catch that, all of we is one. There's no two ways about it. I don't think we need to find a reason for Black and white or pink or yellow, but we should find a reason for culture. Because if you can show people where what your culture is, it brings a better understanding of you. I was speaking to seniors at seniors outreach services when they come in, whether for exercise classes, we play euchre, whatever. And I would tell them about what happened when I was a kid. Tell them how we played when I was a kid. Tell them the fact, and you know, we can talk about children, and I said there's no illegitimate child. They are children out of wedlock. Okay, because in the islands, in our culture, all of a sudden you'll hear, guess who's getting married? And it's somebody you know for years, a very popular, top of the heap person is finally getting married. You thought, as a kid, you'll think that person's married a long time ago. And what happens is like a royal wedding, because then all the people went to flock just to see them go. These people have 6 and 7 kids in the house already. And because we have, it's a culture that says, it's a belonging. This is your family. And if you can explain that culture to people up here, I think even within themselves, they'll start examining the things that they put down, the things that they think is wrong, and learn that, you know, they're looking at some things the wrong way. And don't do it from fear of being put down, but from strength of saying, this is who I am. I'm from Barbados. I'm from Trinidad. This is what we did when we were growing up. And because you can explain that, people can then understand why you do certain things.
Being Black has offered me an opportunity, and that's what I think of it too. Being Black has offered me an opportunity to develop the whole of me. And so when I get into the dramas of, oh, you know, this is a person, oh, I have to sort of pick myself above that drama and say, okay, where am I? So I don't think I would have those lessons if I were other than Black in this part of the world. Mm-hmm. So it's a great, great learning opportunity, although you don't want to do that kind of learning sometimes. You just want to be left alone. But it's still a learning opportunity. You know, it's a very positive one. And you can pull yourself above the drama. And being black has offered me that opportunity to see the drama, to see all the little chaos that's happening. And say, oh, I'm not getting into that.
The process of interviewing, editing, selecting parts of interviews to be pieced together into this radio doc has been an amazing experience. Some sections of interviews I listen to over and over, never tiring of the wisdom or humor or insight provided. Some I found difficult to listen to, stories of discrimination and isolation that resonated with my own experiences or differed so much from what I knew of Kingston. What strikes me now is how many stories are missing, and I apologize for those omissions. I dedicate this project to the community of nods, smiles, and silent recognition, one interview we spoke about as evidence of the potential for more community in Kingston. And for the groups of people who have made, found, and developed community in Kingston, thank you for your strength and perseverance. We hope to join you.
Some of the smartest dummies can't read the language of Egyptian mummies on a fly go a moon and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youths, cause it's not like the future depends on it. We'll save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media pillages, on TV the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a khaki pants and all of a sudden you are say a Indiana Jones. And I take all the gold and take all the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzi I've ever seen and ever known. Put the words on this place that the world can see and that's all that will ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like it'll be at home. Get tricked by the beast but the way them are gonna flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them still can't defeat and them could have never clone. My spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own. Lord.
Yeah. Sabali. That's patience. That's what the old folks told me. Can you get with that? Discovering the world before this world. A world buried in time. Uncovered with rhymes, it gets no realer.
Huh. We born not knowing, are we born knowing all? We growing wiser, are we just growing tall? Can you read thoughts? Can you read palms? Can you predict the future? Can you see storms coming? The earth was flat, if you went too far, you would fall off. Now the earth is round, if the shape changed again, everybody would have started love. The average man can't prove up most of the things that he chooses to speak of. And still run research and find out the root of the truth that you seek of. Scholars teach in universities and claim that they're smart and cunning. Tell them find a cure when we sneeze and that's when their nose stop running. And the rich get stitched up when we get cut. Wanna heal them broken bones in the bush with the wet mud. Can you read signs? Can you read stars? Can you make peace? Can you fight war? Can you milk cows, even though you drive cars? Can you survive against all odds now?
It's crazy. When you feed people the truth, you don't know how they're gonna react. You're scared of wrongdoers. People that's just ignorant. They're scared of the truth. Be patient for now. Who wrote the Bible? Who wrote the Quran? And was it a lightning storm that gave birth to the earth and then dinosaurs were born? Who made up words? Who made up numbers? And what kind of spell is mankind under? Everything on the planet we preserve and can it. Microwave it, try it, no matter what, we'll survive it. What's you? What's man? What's human? Anything along the land we consuming. Eating, deleting, ruin. Trying to get paper. What? Gotta have land, gotta have acres. True. So I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch niggas play the game like the Lakers. In a world crowd full of 52 fakers, gypsies, seances, mystical prayers. You superstitious, throw salt over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz like somebody got a doll of me. Sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it. Sometimes it's like part of me, but I got a real big spirit. A fearless. Don't you try to grab hold of my soul. It's like a military soldier since 7 years old. I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Damn. All the wisdom and knowledge seekers of the world.
Savali, savali, savali.
Patience.
Yeah.